When I give up stuff and when I give up bills, I gain in purpose, in the ability to do what I want to do when I wake up in the morning. Because if I don't have a $100 cell phone bill, which is $1,200 a year, that means $1,200 worth of work that I don't have to do, which means I can be doing what I love to do.
Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors. The man you just heard is Rob Greenfield, and almost everything he does is a bit atypical. He lives on just $5,000 a year, voluntarily. He has no bills to pay, and he does things like bicycling across the U.S., generating zero waste. His story comes to us via another podcast called Wild Ideas Worth Living. They ran an interview with him a few months ago, and it was such an inspiring conversation that we wanted to share parts of it with you. To give you a little background, Wild Ideas Worth Living is a show about people who have a wild idea, an idea that everyone thought was crazy, and made it happen. And this particular episode of theirs, the interview with Rob Greenfield, really stuck with me after I heard it. It's an interview that delves into questions of what we actually need in life in order to be happy, and how depriving ourselves of things that most people see as necessities can actually end up leaving us more fulfilled. Before we get into Rob's story, though, I want to introduce you to the host of Wild Ideas Worth Living. Her name is Shelby Stanger, and I spoke with her this past fall.
I've just always been attracted to people who are especially adventurers and have done something a little more wild. So I interview people who've sailed across the ocean, broken records, started businesses. And the goal was to tell these stories so that you too, listening, wherever you are in the car, on a run, at work, would be able to pursue your own wild ideas.
So how did it get started? Tell me a little bit about the backstory here.
Well, I've been a journalist for about 20 years. And also, you know, I started at age 16 writing about real issues. Like I interviewed, one of my mom was a professor at San Diego State, and I interviewed one of her students who was date raped. And then I did a story about a family member's battle with alcoholism. And those stories changed lives. Like, kids wrote in saying that the stories I wrote really affected them and they were gonna quit alcohol and they were really moved. And so I tasted the power of journalism at a really young age. And I did whatever I could to do adventures, because I loved adventures, and to tell stories for pretty much ever since I was 16. And you know, it got to the point where kind of recently, I just wanted to tell stories in full instead of these tightly edited 250 to 750 word magazine stories. You know, I love people, especially adventurers, especially people who've done something out of the norm, off the cuff, something positive, but that people thought they were crazy for doing. And I've always really been interested in fear, especially what drives people to overcome their fears and pursue their passions at whatever cost. And I'm also interested in how people make a living following their passions. But then there was a time where, I always struggled. Journalism never really paid well. So I also took marketing jobs. And I ran marketing on the women's side at Vans for years. And then I got moved to international sales and marketing. And there was a time in 2009 where I loved my job. It was perfect on paper. Vans is an amazing company. I traveled all around the world and had a great boss, worked with amazing people, but I just wanted to write again. And I was absolutely terrified of quitting this job at Vans. It was a really stable job. And I think most people are terrified of quitting something and doing something that makes zero sense on paper, but I just felt kind of called to be a writer again. And there was a lot of like offers that I kept getting and I couldn't do them because I was at a company. But what I did was I started pitching as like a side hustle. Like I started freelancing. And one of the stories I was doing was for Outside Magazine and they wanted me to interview real athletes who'd achieved amazing feats, meaning they weren't sponsored. Now it's interesting because we actually sponsor athletes today that we probably wouldn't have 10 years ago. Just regular people are getting sponsored and becoming ambassadors for brands. But at that time, you could only become sponsored if you were like winning races and championships surf contests, etc. And in meeting some of these people while doing that story, you know, these were people who were like full-time lifeguards and firefighters or real estate agents. And then for fun, they'd paddle across from Manhattan Beach in LA to Catalina Island, like 26 miles or so, then run a marathon in Catalina, then paddle back. And interviewing these guys about that, I kind of started to get over my own fears about quitting and pursuing my own passions. I figured if these guys could do it, well, maybe I could too. You know, I think the same thing is like, I just love podcasts. I love old school storytelling, and I've always loved the interviewing part of journalism more than the writing part. And there's this quote by Jim Rohn that says, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. You can't always control who your family is or who you work with or like who your friends are sometimes even, but well, you can control your friends and you can actually control the people you listen to. And so I thought podcasting was a way to spend time with people doing amazing things.
And you said, I mean, when you first reached out to me and introduced me to your show, you said that part of the reason you started it is because you wished that something like this existed when you were at that point in life when you were trying to decide, like, am I going to take this step that doesn't make any sense on paper, but that I really want to do? You know, so it sounds like you saw a need for this and said, okay, like, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know of any other female podcasters. I didn't know you then, but like, I didn't know anybody telling these stories. And I think that was the biggest reason. And people would always ask me like, hey, Shelby, I know you interviewed so-and-so. Tell me more. Like your story in Outside or whatever is like 250 words long. Like, and I wanted to tell these stories in full. Exactly. And yeah, I thought there was a need for it. And it's been cool. People have written in saying, hey, some of your stories have affected me. I've quit my job. I'm moving to Alaska. And other people are like, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I was pretty stoked for her. I would follow up. It's awesome. Another person just said, hey, I'm going backpacking and I'm going to go on this amazing trip. Someone just emailed me their video. They're like, hey, I'd been so scared to learn to surf and I'm in Bali and this is me standing up on a wave. So it's pretty cool. I love it.
Tell me about one or two of your favorite guests that you've had on the show. Like, who are they and what did you learn from them?
Kimmy Werner was our age as well. And she is a woman who, there's this famous picture of a young woman swimming with like a 17-foot great white shark holding on to its dorsal fin. And she's a freediver, a huntress. And she talks about the need to slow down in order to speed up. And she talks about this in reference to the shark, but it applies to life. So basically, you know, she had been out with a team of people who were looking for sharks all day long, and they were going to do it in cages. And then at the end of the day, they hadn't seen any sharks. And she's like, hey, can I get in the water? The guy's like, yeah, we haven't seen any sharks. No problem. She gets in the water and immediately there's like a great white shark coming towards her. So she has basically two choices, to panic or to do what she knows deep inside to do, which is slow down, calm down, and then she starts swimming towards the shark. And I don't know what I would have done in that situation, but
I would have panicked probably.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would have gone eaten and died, you know, and Kimmy just like rocked it and then somehow like held on to the shark's dorsal fin. But, you know, don't try this at home. But I think that message of slowing down to speed up, like I took that in my life, like with my podcast, I'm like going, meeting with sponsors and partners. And I do one episode a week and I'm kind of dying. Like it's hard.
Yeah.
I love it. But I think I'm going at a pace that I might not be able to keep up. And so I don't know, last week, for example, I just turned off my computer for an entire weekend, almost pretty much got through the whole weekend and my cell phone pretty much off. And I just came back Monday just so revived. And I think that that's such an applicable lesson. To speed up, you have to slow down. Slowing down is so important.
I love this advice that like when you feel the need to speed up, you should actually slow down. That's when I listened to that episode of your show, I was like, oh gosh, I need to incorporate this into my life like all the time. 'Cause that's definitely my inclination is, you know, when something goes wrong, it's like, okay, go into overdrive and like do everything all at once right now. And that's not always very helpful. But I have to ask.
Yeah, right? Like you're a perfectionist like me, like, and you, I feel like you're a through hiker. And for me, like, I'm a runner. Like, I just, like, if I want to get faster, I feel like, oh, I'll just keep running and run more.
Yeah.
But really, the better advice would be, like, take a break, taper, stop running for right. a couple days, and then you'll come back faster.
So I have to ask, in your weekend of being off the computer and off your phone, what did you go do?
It sounds crazy, but I never watch TV, and someone turned us on to Breaking Bad, and it's not a show I'd normally watch, but the storytelling is so good. So I watched some Breaking Bad. I surfed my brains out. I went to the coffee shop. I went on a hike. I caught up with people. I wrote a little bit, but with a pen and paper, some ideas for my podcast, because I tried not to use my computer. And I slept. And I went to the gym and, like, did the sauna. I had dinner with some friends, and I had a glass of wine, and it was pretty lovely.
I think you're kind of, like, describing my ideal weekend, except I don't know how to surf, so I would probably, like, substitute, I don't know, mountain biking or something for that. But
yeah, it was pretty awesome. Oh, and then our neighbors came over, and we had a pumpkin carving party, and our neighbors are 2 and 3 years old, and they're really cute little girls. And we don't have toys at our house, but we have, like, a Bosu ball and, like, yoga blocks, and they think our house is so fun because we're total minimalist. So we have this, like, huge floor you could do yoga on. They think it's the funnest thing ever. So yeah, we just spent a lot of time, like, hanging out with friends and people we love.
Sounds so nice. So I wanted to ask you about success. So when we talked on the phone earlier before this interview, you sort of brought up this question of success. Like, maybe you don't feel 100% successful in a traditional sense. So I'm curious what success means to you.
Yeah, I think since we talked about that, I thought a lot about success. And I think if you ask me, depending on the day of the week, some days I feel like I've just climbed Everest. And other days I'm like, oh, I'd really like to have enough money to just go out and fly to Fiji tomorrow and go surfing. So, like I said, I live in a pretty affluent community. And what I've learned is that comparison is the biggest thief of joy. So I've started to redefine my own definition of success, because I think social media has messed with me a little bit. And I think my own social media game has probably messed with other people. You know, we only portray our A game on social media, and it's filtered completely. And I don't know, I'm a real competitive person. Like, if you walk down the street with me or we're going on a run, like, I can't help it. I have to be first. It's terrible. And I've had to learn to, like, chill out on that.
You have to win the race all the time.
I like winning, and I've just stopped because it's really annoying being around people who are perfectionists and always want to win. So I have to check myself a lot. So I think I've redefined success is, one, are you bringing the most joy to the most people doing what you do right now? Like, are you creating joy and participating in joy? The second thing is, are you happy with the percentage of time that you're doing what you want, when you want, with who you want?
And it sounds like, based on your rubric for success, I mean, it sounds like you're pretty successful.
I feel pretty successful, but there are times when I'm just like, I just want to go to, like, Fiji tomorrow, which is, like, crazy, right? But I don't have the money. Or, like, I just want to buy a new car. And I think it's because I just live in this really affluent, but I mean, seriously, like, I am so lucky. I have it better than 99.99% of humans. But, you know, I think that's where the comparison part comes in. Like, comparison is the biggest thief of joy. And I just live in this affluent community where, like, driving a Prius is kind of ghetto.
Still, Shelby says when it comes to the really important stuff, she's doing pretty well. She's learning and growing, which are also both big parts of her definition of success. And her work is fulfilling. She talks to inspiring people all the time. Listeners tell her they're making positive changes in their lives because of her show. And the constant deadlines are helping her let go of some of her more rigid perfectionist tendencies.
There are weeks where I cringed at releasing an episode because I think it didn't live up to my standards. But you know what? No one ever wrote in and called or said, hey, you suck, you failed, that episode was terrible. In fact, some of the ones I didn't like ended up being the best ones according to my statistics. You know, for me also, over the course of the year, I set a really lofty goal to do 50 plus episodes. That part became a little unbalanced, and I think that was part that was unsuccessful. So next year, I'm probably going to scale back. I just surfed a lot less, and I really put my pedal to the metal in regards to work. I probably stared at the computer more often than I wanted. I was on the phone, pitching, grinding. I didn't make pretty much any money last year, and that was hard. It was, I had to bite my tongue a lot, and I like making money. I like being able to support myself, and I also like giving money away to people in need, and so I want to get to that point, and I think I'll get there, but like I said, I'm working on it, and for the other part of it, just doing what I want when I want, feeling like I'm doing fulfilling work, yeah, I feel like I have that, so I'm lucky.
So we're going to play some excerpts from one of your episodes. And so I just wanted to kind of set the scene for people. So these come from an episode where you interview a guy named Rob Greenfield. So how did you come across him, and what made you want to interview him for the show?
So Rob actually hit me up 5 years ago, and he's like, hey, I'm biking across the country to raise awareness about sustainability. It's a really good cause. And I was like, okay. I mean, a lot of people bike across the country for a good cause. But I don't know. There was just something about him that I liked. Years later, we stayed in touch. He hit me up. He's like, hey, I just wrote a book. And I looked at the book, and like Ben and Jerry, or Jerry of Ben and Jerry, one of them endorsed his book. It was pretty badass. And he just kept doing these Facebook posts, and I kept following his career, and he would do these wild adventures. And I was like, Rob, when you're back in town, like let's finally meet up again. And he contacted me recently. He's like, hey, Shelby, I'm back in town. And so, yeah, he kind of hit me up. But I think I'm fascinated with Rob because this is the kind of guy I wanted to interview when I started Wild Ideas Worth Living. I love stories of people doing wild things that everyone else says you're crazy for doing, but they're really positive and they did it anyway. And I was really interested, how do you get over fear and self-doubt and what other people might think of you? So Rob has done a lot of things. Not only did he bike across the country once and do it with zero waste, but he's done it now 3 times. Another thing he's done was he lived like the average American for an entire month wearing all the trash he created. He built this like backpack and then wore the trash around him in clear plastic trash bags and walked around the middle of New York City just to show people all the stuff that you create in a month. And then he lives on $5,000 a year. And I'm someone who like kind of likes, like, yeah, I'm a hippie and I sort of like living adventurously, but like, let's be honest, I like nice surfboards and I would like to be able to go to Fiji. So living off $5,000 a year is so wild to me.
And yeah, this was one of the things that like super intrigued me, that he lives on $5,000 a year. Like, he makes more than that, but he gives most of it away, and he only keeps $5,000 for himself. And we're going to hear a little bit about that in your interview with him. But like, how do you do that? A lot of people probably spend $5,000 a month just on basics. So like, how does he pay rent? How does he like pay for gas in his car?
Well, I think for rent, he bought a tiny house that cost $500. And, you know, he has to be relying on other people. So he got to live in the tiny house in his friend's backyard. So he wasn't really renting the land. But he doesn't have a cell phone. He has an iPod Touch. So he uses Google Voice to make phone calls. He doesn't have a car, so he doesn't need gas. And I was like, well, how do you use Uber? And he's like, no, because I don't have a credit card. I don't have bills. So he said his girlfriend has a credit card. So sometimes when they need Uber, they can use her credit card. But otherwise, he bikes or he takes public transportation or just walks. I don't know. It's crazy.
Like, how do you even buy plane tickets? I mean, he travels. Like, this is amazing to me that this is doable. And like, you
know, it's insane.
Right. Okay, without further ado, let's hear some excerpts from Shelby's interview with Rob. And just to set this up, at this point in the interview, they're talking about Rob's wild idea to travel to Brazil with zero money.
Over time, I was learning more and more that I didn't need money to be happy in life and to be purposeful and passionate. And that ultimately I found that the happiest people I've met through all of my travels are people that don't have tons and tons of money. It's often people who have less money who are much happier. And so I started to see that, and I just started to see that when I based my life around other things besides money, when I based it around relationships, love, experiences, connection with the earth, that's what made me feel my best and where I was able to give back. So I set out to try to learn to live with no money, and I found that one of the best ways I could do that was to basically maroon myself in a far-off country with no money. By doing that, I was forced to try to exist without money.
So you went to the airport with a dime, or how did this happen?
So the first time I did it, I left my apartment in San Diego. I had already bought a flight to Cabo, Mexico. I left with just the clothes in my back, my passport, and my cell phone at the time on airplane mode, so I couldn't use it, and no money. And I landed in Cabo, and I didn't know where I was going, had not set anything up. I walked out of the airport. It was a 10-mile walk into town, and I just stuck my hands up in the air and started walking.
And then what happened?
Then I slept on the beach and had a very freezing cold night. I found a wet towel to use as a blanket. The first night was very, very rough. And then the second day I found a computer and went on to couch surfing, and then made some friends through couch surfing, spent a little time there. Eventually, after I got my guts up, I hit the road. I had earned $15 doing headstands on the street. And then I gave 10 of that away, bought a bus ticket for like $3. And when I got to the desert, I had $0. And then I had 1,000 miles to cross.
So what happened next?
Whoa, actually, that's right. I bought a bag of lentils and a bag of rice, and I cooked all of them and put them in a pillowcase. So that's what I had with me. And then after I got rides, people were really nice. They picked me up, and the problem was they were a lot of really short rides. After 24 hours, the lentils and rice went sour, so I had to dump those out. So I had no money. I was in the middle. I mean, the Baja is, some pretty remote area. And after a while, some guy picked me up and was going all the way to the border. And so I was in his car for 17 hours. It was the back of a fish truck that was leaking ice water onto my legs, and it was 50 degrees at night. I came, when we got to the border, I just almost stumbled to my knees from being so cold.
So your first adventure wasn't the most fun, but then you've done other adventures without money, correct?
Yeah. So then I went to Panama. So I did the same thing. This time I flew to Panama, except without my cell phone. It was literally the clothes in my back. So I had sandals, shorts, a shirt, a jacket, a hat, and my passport. 6 total items, no underwear, no toothbrush, no money, no credit card, none of that. Landed in Panama and then had to travel 4,000 miles through Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, Mexico, Guatemala.
Okay, so what are some of the things you did to travel to these places without money? Like, give me some examples and maybe one or two stories.
Well, the first day when I got to, I guess it was about the third day, I found that ultimately to have zero money was very hard. So one of the first things I did is I collected cans. 500 cans amounted to $5. It was definitely the hardest $5 that I ever earned. It took like 12 or 14 hours to earn $5 down there. But ultimately, the idea was by doing this was the mainstream media portrays the world often as this dangerous, violent place. People are afraid to go to Mexico because they think it's this violent place. And the saying, if it bleeds, it leads, is the common narrative in mainstream media. So ultimately, what I wanted to do was by putting myself out there with nothing, I was dependent upon the kindness of humanity. And by being dependent on others, the idea was to see, will people be good to me? Will people help me? And ultimately, that's what got me through all of it. Resourcefulness was a part of it, to test resourcefulness. But ultimately, that trip was about seeing if people are good. And when I got back from that trip, 4,000 miles of traveling, that literally the only words that could come out of my mouth were just, people are good. I just screamed it, people are good, over and over.
If you were here right now, you would see Rob raising his hands in the air and just like embracing motion, saying people are good, which is so cool. So there's two things I have to ask you. One, resourcefulness. You were an Eagle Scout. So if someone is going to live this kind of lifestyle that you did, which is relying on others, which I don't know, I kind of cringe when it's like, I have to rely on others. I don't ever want to have to rely on others. So the resourcefulness part of it, what kind of skills do you need to do something like this?
Well, there's actually a really important, almost a slightly more important part than the resourcefulness, and that is the inability to rely on others, because that's how I've always felt. As an Eagle Scout, you're prepared for everything. As an American, generally the idea is don't depend on anyone else for anything, be independent, earn everything. But ultimately, I think that is one of our biggest flaws, is that there's 7 billion of us on this earth. We don't have another earth. We have to work together. The idea that money can make us independent is a total illusion. Someone is doing that for you. You're just erasing the humanity of it by making it a monetary transaction instead. And so ultimately, like, people like you and I are often good at giving, but to receive is a skill that we don't have. And so in order to learn to receive, I had to force myself to do it. And ultimately, by learning to receive, it helped me to put myself in the shoes of others so that I could be better at giving and being compassionate, because I needed that compassion in that time.
Hey, it's Willow again. We'll come back to the interview in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Support for Out There comes from Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people get lower rates on their life insurance. You know how you can save money on your car insurance if you're a good driver? Health IQ is kind of like that, only with life insurance. They're catering to runners, cyclists, hikers, vegetarians, basically anyone who leads a healthy lifestyle. Physically active people have a much lower risk of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, etc., which is why Health IQ is able to save its customers up to 33% on life insurance. To learn more and see if you qualify, just go to healthiq.com/out there. That's healthiq.com/out there. And as always, we've got a link to that on our website. And now back to Shelby's interview with Rob Greenfield.
There's a couple of other wild ideas I want you to talk about on this show. One is dumpster diving. Why dive in dumpsters? And maybe you can tell me some stats about food waste and then some things you find in dumpsters.
Sure. That ultimately is the resourcefulness that you were just asking about. That is one of the things that allows me to have adventures that cost almost nothing. So when I first started dumpster diving, it was April of 2013, about the time that I had reached out to you. And I was embarrassed at the concept of diving into a dumpster, you know, eating garbage. You know, I had a big ego at the time. It wasn't something that I really wanted to tell people, but I was doing this bike ride trying to have the least impact possible. So what better way to have no impact than to find stuff that's going to waste? So I started to open up grocery store dumpsters and just started to find that dumpster after dumpster after dumpster is filled to the brim. And I'm talking filled to the brim with perfectly good food. And
perfectly good food.
So for example, you know, you have a 5-pound bag of oranges. One orange is bad, so they throw away the whole thing. Even crazy things like a 24-pack of bottled water, one bottle springs leak, so they throw away the whole 24-pack. Things are thrown away often a month or more before the suggested sell-by date. So things like boxes of Kashi granola bars or cereals or Kind bars, chocolate, you know, then organic fruits and vegetables. You know, the last week we got maca powder out of the dumpster. So you can find health food, or if you're in the mood for a dozen donuts, you know, things like that, or pizza, you can find in this country anything you want in the dumpsters, basically.
Wow. So are dumpsters generally open? Because the one closest to my house is like, you can tell there's like a security guard next to it. It's
yes.
A really high-end grocery store.
Yeah. So I've been in over 2,000 dumpsters across the United States in 30 states. And I've found generally about half dumpsters are accessible and half not, maybe 60-40 or something like that. So it's really a numbers game. And if you're on an adventure, whether you're biking across the country or you're on a rock climbing trip and you're passing through towns, it's really just if you stop in enough dumpsters, you're going to find more food than you could eat and share with all of your friends. And you're going to run into the problem of having way too much food.
And I know you've talked about this. Like, do you have any stats you can share with the audience about food waste?
Sure. So we waste $165 billion worth of food per year. That's billion with a B. And to give you an idea of how much that is, that's more than the budgets for America's national parks, public libraries, federal prisons, veterans healthcare, the FBI, and the FDA combined. So it's a massive number. We waste 40% or more of all of our food, so about half of all our food, which means we produce enough food to feed two entire American populations. So take all 50 states, double that, and that's how much food we're producing, while about 1 in 7 million, or 1 in 7 Americans, which is about 50 million Americans, are food insecure.
Food insecure meaning?
So food insecure basically means that people don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And it doesn't mean every day. You know, some days maybe they've got their three meals, but it means that sometimes those people don't know where their next meal is coming from.
1 in 7?
1 in 7. And it's actually like people think, you know, when they think of hunger, they think often of like homeless people. But in reality, hunger is much more elders, children, single mothers. The face of homelessness can't be stereotyped. It's a huge number of people and it's a huge range of people. I mean, 1 in 7 Americans means you're walking past people that are struggling for food probably every single day. And you just don't know it because that's the society that we live in, where all of these things are behind the scenes and they're out of sight, out of mind.
You've actually started to raise awareness about food waste through this dumpster diving, and you do kind of group dumpster dives. And so first off, how did you get over your insecurity to dive in dumpsters? And tell me about what your girlfriend thought of all of this.
Sure. Well, I got over it because what I found is the best way to get myself over things is by having to force myself to do it. So the reason I got past it is because on the bike ride, I had to bike across the country having no impact. So I made that adventure. I put it out there. People knew I was doing it. So then I had to do it. So that's how I get myself to get outside of my comfort zone. I come up with a plan, I announce it, and then I've got to do it. And I'm an honest person. So then I have to actually do it. So that's kind of been my strategy of getting past things and getting outside of my comfort zone. And then as far as my girlfriend now, at the time when I started dumpster diving, she wasn't my girlfriend. She disapproved of it. Her mom disapproved of it. She told me on the phone not to tell anyone that I was dumpster diving. Fast forward, we are now together. She doesn't dumpster dive, or she doesn't get in the dumpster with me, but she'll stand there and I pass the food out to her. And so I always say it's proof that you can eat the trash and have the girl too.
You can eat the trash and have the girl too. Have you ever gotten into trouble doing this?
So I've had the police come twice out of 2,000 dumpsters, so a pretty low ratio. One time the police in Iowa, we made friends. They added me to Facebook about a half hour later. A week later, I was on the news in Wisconsin, and the news had pulled a picture that I put of me and the police on my Facebook page and put it on the news. And then I saw the police Facebook page saying, "Hey, our friend Rob got us on the news in Wisconsin." So, and the other time the police came, and weirdly enough, somebody came out of the store and walked up to the police officer and said, "Hey, I told him he could be in there," even though he hadn't. He just kind of saved me. So I haven't been in trouble. However, because I am a white, you know, male in the United States.
I was just going to ask you that. I was like, but you're a white male with like this huge smile. You're young.
Yep. So I have, you know, privileges that make all of this easier. All of my adventures, traveling through South America with no money, dumpster diving, all of these things are easier because I have these, you know, privileges that I'm born with. So if you're homeless, dumpster diving is a different story because the police are more likely to hassle you. I went dumpster diving with some black guys down in Southside Chicago, and they were scared of getting shot being back there in the dumpster in the night. So to help with that, I started the Dumpster Divers Defense Fund, which if you ever get ticketed or arrested for dumpster diving, it'll pay all of your costs, get you out of jail, and bring media attention to it. So
how can I live with less? Like, we were just talking and I said, you know, I eat a mostly plant-based diet, but even about my vegetables, like my spinach comes in this giant plastic bin. I go to Trader Joe's and I think I'm being so smart because it's really inexpensive and I can get tons of veggies, but they're all wrapped in plastic. So I try to go to the farmer's market. And even then, like, the tomato guy has to put his tomatoes in plastic bags. Like what can we do if we're not going to be completely extreme like you to start living with less, especially when it comes to food?
Yeah. And that is the whole idea. I do extreme things to draw attention, but the message isn't for anyone listening to this to go out and cover themselves in trash, dive into every dumpster they see, you know, travel with no money. Sure, do those things if you want to, but the message is all about what can we do as individuals where we are at home, at work, at school, to have a more positive impact. So people do get caught up like, I can't do that. But again, that's not the point. We can all do so much wherever we live. So as far as, you know, trying to create less trash when it comes to food, because that's where so much of the trash was, shopping in bulk is a really big one. So you have co-ops, like here in San Diego, there's the Ocean Beach People's Co-op, but around the country, there's thousands of co-ops, and there's all sorts of grocery stores that have bulk food sections where you can get all your grains, nuts, you know, seeds, flour, you know, hundreds of different items, even things like chocolate and candies can come unpackaged. So that's one thing, carrying your own reusable bag, carrying your own reusable bottle. And then a big part of it is reprioritizing our lives. Ultimately, everyone listening to this podcast probably has the ability to reprioritize their life because we are a group of people who probably have a lot more freedom than many people. So it comes down to, is it worth it? Putting, like, for example, if it is more expensive to shop at the farmer's market, but probably we're putting money into something else somewhere that maybe isn't even good for us. Maybe it's $100 a month in liquor, for example, or
kombucha
beer.
And coffee.
So make your own kombucha. That's a huge one.
Terrible for you.
It costs a quarter. Oh, you don't like kombucha?
No,
anyway.
It's good. I like it. I just don't. I really believe that the kind you buy at the store is basically glorified soda water with a healthy label on it.
Oh man, I do love my kombucha. That's actually one of my few crutches in life.
It's terrible, but okay. So you can. You're right. I want to keep going into this, but I want to dive deeper. You live with just less overall. You said you have 111 possessions to your name. You basically live out of a backpack. And if you look at Rob, like, he's a good looking guy. He looks like you and I. He's an adventurer. You know, I think a lot of people on this podcast might just think you're a trust fund kid and you have a big cushion to fall back on. Is that true? Can we just dispel this myth?
Yeah, that's you talk about internet trolls. That's a big one, like trust fund hippie kid. So I grew up, my mom had me and three siblings and no dads. And we had three different dads. And she made $15,000 a year to support the four of us. We lived in a two-bedroom house. My mom had a bunk bed with my sister until she was like 12. The three of us boys shared a room. And so we, you know, we were pretty low income. You know, I didn't start with a single. In high school, I had saved up to about $2,000. Like, I got a paper route when I was in sixth grade. Worked at Hardee's in ninth grade, you know, so I've always worked hard. No trust fund ever, you know.
But you can live with less, and I think all of us want to do that because it seems like you're really free, you're really happy, you have this glow about you. Like, how can I just live with less money, less possessions, and not have to be so worried about my sponsors supporting this podcast and making money?
Well, so minimalism is a hot thing right now, and it's not just about possessions. It's an entire mindset. And the thing is, like, people think of what you're going without, but what I've found is that the more that I've given up, the more that I've received. Because when I give up stuff and when I give up bills, I gain in purpose in the ability to do what I want to do when I wake up in the morning. Because if I don't have a $100 cell phone bill, which is $1,200 a year, that means $1,200 worth of work that I don't have to do, which means I can be doing what I love to do. And so it's like these things about where I, in the past, I thought were giving up. I've just received so much in freedom and purpose and passion and health by living this simpler life.
How do you contact people? Like, we communicated all day and yet you don't have a cell phone.
So I use Wi-Fi wherever I am, and I use Google Voice. So it's a free number. It works just like no one knows it's not a cell phone in the sense that it appears as the same number. You can get
but
text.
But you have a phone.
I don't have a phone. I just use a computer, and I also have an iPod Touch. Those are my two technological type things.
That's amazing. So an iPod, but do you have Instagram?
I have Instagram, which is the iPod Touch, which is, works for that. So I just communicate when I'm on Wi-Fi, which ultimately, you know, people worry about the idea of not having a cell phone and being, you know, too disconnected. But our problem is being overconnected, never having that moment to relax. And so I found that in the busy world that we live in today, I've had to do things that force myself to do what I want to do. So by not having a cell phone, it forces me that when I go outside, I'm present where I am. And presence is something that's worth way more than any money that I could ever earn. To be able to exist in a way that for so many of us can't even fathom anymore, even though 20 years ago, everybody existed that way. But
I mean, less than that.
Yeah, it's crazy how quickly this whole thing has changed.
I hope my mother and all my friends addicted to their cell phones are listening to this podcast. This is so awesome that you don't have a cell phone and you don't have a lot of things.
Yeah. And so, you know, talk about exercises. Here's an exercise. One day, take your cell phone, turn it off, put it in your sock drawer or whatever, and go out for the day. That's a practice. I had been completely cell phone dependent until Thanksgiving Day 2013, I think. I couldn't even fathom the idea of leaving the house without my cell phone. And I just was like, I'm going to do it for 24 hours. Left it at home. I felt so naked going outside without it. I was like, hey, friends, just so you know, like, I'm going out and you won't be able to reach me. And it was a day never to forget. That it was a feeling I hadn't felt in years.
That was Shelby Stanger, host of Wild Ideas Worth Living. To hear the full interview, you can go to wildideasworthliving.com. Shelby is now partnering with REI, and her first episode of 2018 comes out on January 10th. A big thank you to Dawn Putney, Brett Andrich, Susan Barlow, Brett Winkler, Melanie Minos, Jean-Marie Pena, Sam Shapinski, and Deb and Vince Garcia for their financial contributions to Out There. Listeners are our most reliable source of income. You guys make the show possible. If you'd like to make a contribution of your own, just go to outtherepodcast.com and click support. You can make a one-time donation, or even better, you can contribute to our Patreon campaign, which lets you make smaller donations on a monthly basis. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking, and our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.